I'm here in Talla and I'm talking to Liam Roach. Liam, born in 1946, a Saggart man, would I be right in saying that?
Well, very much now a Saggart man anyway. I was born in the city and my parents lived in Kildare for a while. We emigrated and I seem to have spent the last 100 years living in Saggart, my married life, and married a local girl, and my son was born there as well.
Can we go back and start at the beginning? How far back can you trace your own family?
I can trace my own family to some roots around the late 1800s. And certainly the new publication of the census has helped when you can sort of clarify some information, and then talking, like we all have regrets, I suppose, that we didn't talk more to our parents and talk more to our elderly aunts and uncles and so on. But I don't know whether it was me or I had an inquiring mind, but I seem to make notes when I did get some droplets of information from my parents and from my my aunts and uncles about where the family came from. So I suppose the 1880s, 1890s, my father was born in 1908, and I'm anxious now. I have two brothers and a sister. I'm anxious now that this very month would be his centenary, and everyone celebrates the centenary of the demise of people, and so they should, but I think there's something to be celebrated in the birth of a person as well, you know. So it happens this month, and maybe we'll get together and maybe we'll all compare notes and maybe get people to give their memories and of my immediate family, and I'll make some more notes.
And where were you brought up, Liam?
I was brought up in County Kildare near Ballymore Eustace. My family emigrated to England, and spent my sort of secondary teaching in secondary education in South London, and then I came back and I did a technical qualification in Bolton Street, and then I got married and we lived in Saggart ever since. That was in the early 70s.
And your schooling days?
My schooling days, as I say, was initially near Ballymore. We lived for a short while in Robertstown, and then most of my real schooling was probably done in St Gerard's School in Clapham in London. And then technical training was in, it's now Dublin DIT. It was then Bolton Street College of Technology.
And what did you go on to do as soon as you finished?
I was a draftsman. I always had an interest in drawing, and I always had an interest. I just thought it was a good way maybe to get a job in those days. They were actually building Ballymun at the time. And I remember there was actually jobs going. It was the sort of late 60s. There was a few jobs going for technical people, and I got a job there as a draftsman on a day release. And I went on then to sort of more or less stay with construction and building.
Mm-hmm. But you've also taken a great interest in the history, especially the history now of your own place, Saggart. And, you know, kind of, I suppose being a draftsman and having an interest in the planning, and then you'd also have an interest in the older buildings and how they came about and when they were built and so on.
Well, yes, that's right. I suppose that led to an interest, sort of a mixture of art and buildings. Funny mixture, but I still am always interested in art and in art relating to buildings and structures. I don't know why, rather than just portraits and things like that, but I got involved with a group who a friend of mine called Peter Pearson, who asked me to get involved with the restoration of Drimna Castle. And I suppose that was really dipping my toe in the water. And that was in the early 70s. And the castle is now it was in a ruinous state at that time. The Christian brothers had moved out and had built a school adjacent to the castle, and the castle was just in no man's land. And it was a fantastic structure, and out in the suburbs of Dublin, with its own moat and its own history, of course, a Norman castle. And it's been restored, and thankfully that's the way it is today.
And were you involved in that?
I was involved as a helper. I was a member of the committee. We all had a part to play insofar as trying to raise funds and trying to get people to do work, and trying to raise information on the history of the castle.
And how sympathetically was it restored to its original state?
I would say, with my sort of training as a draftsman and my interest in sort of architecture, I would say it was restored very sympathetically.
Mm-hmm.
And the features, it's like I suppose a lot of buildings, medieval buildings, it sort of reflects the periods that it lived through and how people made changes, added on, and other parts just fell away. But I think Drimnagh Castle was very lucky that there was people involved, and the OPW certainly helped out insofar as they allowed one of their conservation architects to get involved with the project, and he was very good.
Was that David Slattery?
David Newman Johnson.
Oh, David Johnson.
Yeah. And he was very good, and he became a sort of a consultant on the project, and he was able to give direction to the committee as to what type of work they were doing.
What about the materials? Were they sourced locally, and exactly, you know, when it came to the mortar and the lime and the stone and so on?
Insofar as they could be, they were actually traced, believe it or not, to the same quarry, Belgard, which is not too far from where I live in Saggart. They were traced to there, and stone from that quarry was used to reinstate parts of the building. There was a very good man there called Pat McAvee, who was working for Foss at the time.
Stone man.
Yes, Irish Stone Walls is his book, and he actually trained some of the apprentices, and Foss were very, very supportive of the project.
Yeah, that's interesting. What about the timber then?
Timber was taken. The design for the roof, which had to be reinstated in the Great Hall, was taken from a similar building of the same period, from North County Dublin. I can't think of the name of the one. It might be Killallen Castle or somewhere near Swords, somewhere out near Swords, and it was copied. And there was oak was used on that castle, and they reckon that it was the same type of timber that was used on Drimnagh Castle.
So it was recycled oak, isn't it?
It was recycled oak, yes, and there was certainly some materials donated from some of the warehouses in the Docklands at the time that they were being demolished. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, but that's where some of the timber is.
Yeah. Well, wasn't that an interesting project to get involved in it from an early stage?
Very interesting. Yeah.
And that was in 1972.
That was in the 1972 and early 70s, and it sort of gave me Saggart was still very much a small single village. You know, as they say, two pubs, a post office, and a shop. And a school, of course. And there were some very interesting people around the place, and we began to get in touch, and there was a local community council. And I always sort of steered myself towards the history side of the place, and there were several other people involved as well. And we began to look at what was around us in the village, you know, and found that we were literally steeped in history.
Mm-hmm. What about the mill there? That was a great, a lot of people actually were working in the mill that were living locally around Saggart.
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed. If you like, that's when I say we were steeped in history. If you like, we had a strong ecclesiastical beginning. We had a famine day church, a famine time church, famine period church. We were part of the Pale, because we had a Pale castle, and then, unlike a lot of other areas, we had an industrial heritage in, as you mentioned, the mill, the Swiftbrook paper mill in Saggart, which was a strong industrial type of operation, which went through two periods from the early industrial age of you know, water power right through to electric diesel power.
Yeah. What about the people in Saggart? Were they migrants coming from other parts of the country, or were they deeply rooted families living in Saggart?
Well, early times, well, early my times, Saggart would have been a sort of a mixture of deeply rooted people, mostly of farming stock. Mm-hmm. And then there had also been, there also is, and there still is today, of course, a number of people from mostly the south of the country who had been granted parcels of land by the Land Commission. We have a number of Kerry names in the area, and Scanlon is one of them. And they still have their roots. And I always talk to Mick Scanlon, and I know he has worries when Kerry's playing Dublin. And that's when his old sort of feelings come out again, you know.
But it's sometimes it's very obvious that the family names you would find, you know, in Kerry, O'Connor's, McCarty's, and so on. But up here in Dublin, what are the family names living in South County Dublin in that area?
Well, I always think it's a little bit different as well to have you know, to have such a colourful section of population, because we have, as I say, some deeply rooted people, and then we have people who came into the area. And the names that always stand out for me now is names like Archibald, families of Archibalds, families of Grassicks. And we have plenty of Burns and O'Toole's, because, as you probably are aware, they were the people of the Dublin stroke Wicklow area who were renowned families and clans of that area. Indeed, Saggart, when it was a pale village, or part of the Pale, was attacked and burned by septs of the Burns, and several of the houses around the big estate in Saggart, which is called Tas Saggart, were destroyed, and anything that wasn't nailed down was taken. Mm-hmm. Cattle and livestock were certainly driven away, and well, the Burns and O'Toole's, that was their way of life, I suppose. But we, as I say, with those names, we have Muldowneys, several other people around the area. Vivash, which is an unusual name, and we have Earls. So they're really the names that sort of, you know, stand out for me as being a little bit less unusual in the Irish context.
The architecture, which would be very much your field, it doesn't really have it's an old village which has grown immensely now today, but for a long time it stood still as a village, a small village with little cottages and the odd big house here and there.
Indeed, yes, that's true. In fact, I would say that the I would say that the decent sort of vernacular architecture was mostly of an agricultural type. There's a fine house now in the middle of the village, Kelly's Farm, which is probably about 1906. Insofar as unusual is that it's a sort of an Edwardian type of house, but it's built of brick, and very few houses were built of brick. It was either stone or rubble or something like that. And it's a lovely house. It's right in the middle of an area that's been developed. And the village has a lovely scale to it, insofar as like a lot of other Irish villages, it had two-story houses right in the centre of the village. Both of them were businesses. One was a pub. The two of them were pubs, and one was a shop. And then there was a number of small cottages along the entrance to the village on both sides. And then we have a very fine school, again a two-story house built of mostly rubble, but a lovely old-fashioned school, maybe the same period as I mentioned for the farmhouse. And as people who were older than I and have now since passed on used to tell me, when they went to that school, in fact my father went to that school, the teachers, which had to be husband and wife, lived upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad to say that the building did fall into ruin, but somebody has bought it and without too much persuasion reinstated the building, and it's now used, I think, as about three or four apartments with some extensions built onto it. But the building is actually very much as you would have seen it visually in its day.
Yeah, looking at old photographs of Saggart, a lot of the houses were thatched and afterwards re-slated. Would that be
that is quite right. There was a line of thatched houses along the main street, single-story thatched houses, mostly with big gardens where people could grow vegetables and so on. There's a priest who came to the parish. I'm not sure if he was looking forward to it or not, but I found some notes that he had written, and he didn't say too much complimentary about the place that he had been sent. He said the people are all unruly, and the houses are falling down, dilapidated and falling down, and mostly with half doors hanging off. And I'm trying to quote as accurately as I could, but I think that's the way it was. If you think about what it was like in the 1920s and 30s, and indeed the 40s, Saggart suffered like anywhere else. It was just a place where there was very little work. We were very fortunate that if you did get a job in the mill, it was really the only, apart from working for a local farmer, it was the only real source of employment.
Where did your father work?
My father worked for Lucan Dairies. He collected milk for Lucan Dairies, which had their depot in Parkgate Street. And he was born on the North Circular Road, although the family moved fairly when he was quite young to Rathcoole. And when he left school, he bought himself a little truck, and he got a contract to collect milk from surrounding farmers
and deliver it to the creamery in,
bring it to Parkgate Street. Bring it into Parkgate Street, which I suppose was the creamery. I've never heard it being called the creamery, but I suppose that's what it was. The archway is still there. It's right opposite Ryan's pub as you go down Parkgate Street. The archway is actually still there, and I remember that because he used to bring us as children for a treat, and we'd be fortunate enough that he might be delivering milk from the depot out to Ernie's chocolate factory on Belgard Road, and a man there would give us a box. I always remember that, a box of what we used to call broken chocolate, and that was a great treat.
And was this seconds from the factory, or was it a I mean, when you say broken chocolate, where?
It was probably chocolate that was sort of fallen off the conveyor belt or something like that, you know, and picked up in the box. It was like a treat the staff used to, I think the staff used to get it, and he used to, or maybe he bought it, I don't know, but he certainly used to get a little box from some of the people there, and he'd be able to give it to us.
Yeah, so that was a trip that you really enjoyed going on.
Very much so, yeah, very much so. It was a nice treat. Yeah. And of course, Ernie's factory in Belgard Road then, in those days, in the 50s, was very much out in the, you know, the edge of the city. Very much out in the edge of the city.
All of these places were very cut off in there were little villages from, say, Racoole and Saggerton, Brittas, and
Newcastle.
Even down to Blessington and Newcastle.
Newcastle,
they were all little villages in the area.
Yeah. So I suppose we were sort of looked at as sort of sister villages, like, but there'd be rivalry between, you know, there'd be rivalry between the,
in football matches?
In football matches, between the local villages then, and you could even put Clondalkin in that group, you know, until it expanded, you know, rapidly in the 70s and 80s. But certainly Saggart and Rathcoole and Newcastle and Brittas to a lesser extent, they were rival villages, and sometimes maybe to be between the young fellas of the area. Maybe there was not too much love lost at times, you know, and it manifested itself maybe at the local dance hall or on the football field.
Would it really?
Yes, it would. I've heard stories that if a fellow was I've nothing to qualify this, but if a fellow was going from a girl from Newcastle, you know, he might be frowned upon, and he'd have to move very quietly through the area, you know.
because he would be seen as an outsider.
Yeah, he'd seen as a little bit of an outsider, you know, from the adjoining parish, and she'd be seen as a local girl maybe, or something like that, you know.
Yeah, did class distinction come into it?
No, I didn't think that one too deeply now. I wouldn't be too much aware, but we were always aware of a big house. You know, we were always aware of a big house, and it was always somewhere in the fields and behind trees. So, I mean, it was just so far removed, you just didn't mix with the people, you know, from that type of environment. But in Saggart, as I say, we were very fortunate. We have a wonderful old house, which evolved through a few stages, like up from Victorian times, which was an original farmhouse, and then an Edwardian wing was added onto it, and we had the remains of a tower house, which gave us, meant we were part of the Pale, which spread, you know, from the city through Clondalkin, you know, Terenure, and then on further out towards Selbridge, and enclosed the land, as you know, enclosing the lands then of Meath and Kildare as part of the lands that were under, 15th, 16th century English rule.
Yeah. You mentioned Archibald as a name. Now, that's Norman, and there would be a lot of other Norman names in the area, so many descendants of from the Norman times.
Yes, indeed. Yes, Archibald was a name in Saggart. Grassic, I'm not sure of the origins of that. And even my own name, Roach, is of course a Norman name, and you get a lot of Roaches in the Wexford, Cork area. And they would have been, we would have been descended from Normans.
Normans, and yes, of course, and the Butlers,
yeah.
And
there are so
many.
That's right.
But the it's interesting the landscape and how much the landscape has changed. And you pointed out how people generally would kind of keep to themselves or keep together. Would that happen in marriage as well? Would the local bai usually wind up marrying a local girl rather than going outside and finding a girl from another parish.
That was really very much the case. That was really very much the case. And I don't have any direct evidence of matchmaking or anything like that. And maybe it just wasn't necessary. But certainly, romance within the parish was something.
For example, your father, did he marry a local girl?
No, he didn't actually. He didn't. He married. My mother was from farming stock in Kildare, and they met through mutual friends in the city.
Oh, I see.
So, even today, we have local weddings, and thanks to social activities like the GA club and other ways of keeping young people within the area. And I always remember a neighbour of mine, she worked in the mill, she worked in the paper mill, and she told me that Evelyn Carroll, and she told me that a feature of their social round was a dance on Stevens's Night, and there was a pavilion in the mill which was built by the owners, the MacDonald family, and it was for the use of, in fact, I think there was tennis courts there, but they were long gone, as was the pavilion, although I did find the area, thanks to her, where it was built, and there was some remains. It would have been, to my mind anyway, it would have been something like a tennis pavilion, or even maybe a slightly cricket type of pavilion, you know. But it was built for the staff, and there was a supper dance, I think they called it, and there'd be sandwiches and tea. And she said the local girls, including herself, and they would all gather in the mill and in the pavilion, and come 10 o'clock, the doors would open, and most of the fellas would make their way in after being in the pub for the evening. So she said it was great fun.
Other traditions in villages generally, well, in rural villages, you would have certain days like Patron Days and, the festival days. Was that the case in Saggart as well?
No, not really now in my time. I suppose, like a lot of villages, it's in some ways the social life centred around the pub more than it should, but thanks to a very active GAA and the committee down through the years, it has developed nicely, and there's a very attractive clubhouse, and it's very welcoming for local people, not just for footballers and visiting teams, you know. And it's actually building up a little bit better now, that there is more social events.
But was there always a tradition of football in the area, or was it hurling, or was it a mixture of both?
Well, it was always football. I believe there's a hurling team in Rathcool, but there was always a football team in Saggart. My father played for it, and they celebrated their anniversary, their centenary, and they did some marvelous work in getting together old photographs. And put out an appeal, and people were looking in the wardrobes and in old books about old photographs that were taken, because I remember at the time my father was playing during the 1940s and the 50s. Well, I don't remember the 40s and the 50s, but I remember hearing him talking about it. There wasn't any photographers around there. It was a rare thing if somebody had a camera. So it's unfortunate that that there wasn't as many records as we have now, and that's why when they do appear, they're very important.
What about the colour of the jersey, the football jersey?
There's a lovely green and blue hue in the jersey, a beautiful Chalk Mirra emblem.
Yeah. Where did the green and blue come from?
I don't know. I'm sorry to say it like that, but I just don't know now. And they have done some work on the club, and I'm sure there is a very good reason for it. whether it was a copy of one of the cities or the city colours or the Dublin colours, it's a darker blue, or whether it was green for the countryside, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. What about success? Was there a success in the club?
There has been many successes, but unfortunately, I'm not qualified really now to ream them off.
Yes. Did you play football yourself?
I was always a little bit of the lesser of the family. My brother was a very good footballer, and I think he overshadowed us. But I didn't play for Mary's certainly, but I enjoyed playing rugby at a lower level.
Yes.
For a while. Yeah.
But you mentioned there cricket or the tennis and cricket. Were they games that were played in the past?
No, not in Sagard, to the best of my knowledge. But you see, cricket was associated, apart from it being associated as being a foreign game, which is it was a terrible thing, but that was the way we were always looked on it. It was associated with the big house. So I would not be a bit surprised now if somebody, and I, you know, when you're interested in history and local history, you learn things all the time. I mean, in North Dublin, there's a great history of estate cricket, as they call it. And there is still clubs today out in the rural parts of North County Dublin.
But that was not the case
down
here.
That was not particularly the case. Around our area, football was really, Gaelic football was really the dominant sport.
Yeah,
you know.
Looking at the Sagard, I suppose in the 19th century, it was predominantly it was Catholic mostly. Was it Catholic? 95% of the population there would have been Catholic. Was
very
it?
Very much so. Very much so, and there's a parish church of the Protestant community, the Church of Ireland in Rathcoole, but Sagard's ecclesiastical history goes back to indeed the time of St. Kevin in Glendalough, because the present graveyard in the village, the burial ground, has an old section and a new section. And the old section, there are some serious remains, including headstones. There's a Celtic cross that has been dated. Paddy Healy has written extensively about it, but there's a Celtic cross that has dated to the time of the early church, which would have been around the 7th century. And then there's evidence that there's the remains of a church, a small church in that particular area. And it's believed that there's a saint from Glendalough called Mosacker, who's associated with Sagard, and Sagard being the name for the house of the priest that gave his name to the village. And of course, if there was any sort of a small community like that, there was always going to be maybe a little bit of work, maybe some arms, maybe some protection from bad times. And I think there is enough evidence now to say that that's how Sagard developed, and as a small Christian community with a cell of monks in the area, working in the area. Maybe it was a breakaway group. We're not too sure of that yet. We may come across some other evidence, but certainly it would have been associated with Kevin in Glendalough, and that remained the case right up to penal times, when the church fell into ruin.
Mm-hmm. Such a depth of history, as you said. Yeah.
Yeah. And this particular church that we have now, which is on the other side of the road from where the old burial ground is. Is one of the few churches that was built outside the city, very soon after emancipation. It was dedicated in 1849 by a man called Daniel Murray, who was Archbishop of Dublin. And again, we celebrated you know, 150 years for that church. But it was very unusual insofar as why was a church being built in a place that just had no real population, just had no funding, no money? And the answer was that it was a spin-off from a member of the family in the mill, the MacDonald family, who actually became a Jesuit, and a very strong local committee. He made funds available, and I believe there was, from what I've read, there was work for people who, especially a man who had a horse and dray, to bring stone from Belgard, to bring timber from the docks in the city to build a church. And it's a fantastic church of its time. It really is a revelation, and it's a wonderful sort of effigy in the village as you approach it. And I always tell people to admire the craftsmanship, the stonework and the plaster work.
Is there any evidence of local workmanship at that time building the church?
It's getting vaguer and vaguer, unfortunately. But my father did tell me that he had heard of people coming from, you know, from Bourne or Breena, from people, carpenters, from skilled stonemasons and helpers coming. And what they would do is they would work with a stonemason. And of course, young men then were trained in the craft of cutting stone. When you think about each piece around the windows and around the doors being cut by hand, and then the way the roof was constructed was it's absolutely fantastic. You know, the skill that was held together with wooden pegs. And the plaster work, which is very Irish, because you can see, if you look up closely and examine it closely, you can see sort of Irish type effigies like shamrocks and so on in the plaster work.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And to the trained eye, obviously, yeah, like yourself, you'd spot these things. Yeah. And these are the things that should be pointed out as well in a church like that.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. And the tower people sometimes have, well, they still do today. They think it's a Church of Ireland church or a Protestant church because it's got the square tower, whereas the tradition was the pointed spire in our churches. But it was because of the period it was being built. And if you look at some of the churches around the city and the bigger towns around Ireland, you'll find similarities. And I can see the hand of, well, if not himself, sort of Pugin's influence, because he went in for this new sort of revival, Gothic revival, as they call it then. You know, with the pointed windows and the pointed doors. And Sagart is a model for that. Just a model for it.
Augustus Pugin would be obviously the man.
Yeah.
Who it'd be interesting to research. Sure. It wouldn't be too hard to find that out, I'm sure. Did you do any restoration to that, or were you involved in any work in that church?
In the church?
Yes.
No, except to produce a small booklet for the 150th anniversary, where we had a celebration, a wonderful celebration of the time that the church reached its 150th year, and the people who had worshipped there, and you know, people were able to tell stories that there was certain seats in the church that you didn't go into because they were sixpenny seats, as they used to call them. Again, my father had told me about that, where the poorer people would have been more or less at the back of the church, and they'd put a penny in the plate. Now, the relationship between the money and where you went to the church, but there was always seats reserved for the higher hierarchy of the village, of
the well
parish, yeah, of the parish.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it did, in fact, the maintenance and the caretaking of the church, that it's held its own, did it, over the years?
I fail to understand how our priests have managed to keep the church in such good order down through the years. Now, as it happens right now, there is some major restoration work going on. And this is the first major restoration since the church was built. There was certainly trouble in the 1940s. I think the walls had to be relined and things like that, but it wasn't anything major. We have now have some severe timber problems in the roof, and some plaster work has broken away. But our present parish priest has brought in consultants, and the work is in hand, and there's fundraising underway, and I know it's going to be done very tastefully. But there's some features in the church as well, because I, as far as I know, when the church was consecrated on that day, there was hardly any seats in it. Probably a number of seats were maybe borrowed or something, you know. Mm. But there was something like 400 people, you know, had gathered, and most of the people from around the parish and the district, because it was such a wonderful occasion. And if you think about an occasion in 1849, you know, when the bishop and his entourage have come all the way out from the city in his coach, you know, and driven out to the wilds of the, you know, the extremities of his diocese, maybe, you know,
yeah.
to dedicate a new church. And it was certainly an occasion, and he would have driven past Kilmainham Hospital was still in use at that time. He probably would have seen some of the old soldiers,
yeah,
pottering around there as he came out that way through Inchicore. The canal was built, so he would have crossed the canal, and then he would have seen maybe Belgard Castle. But there wouldn't have been many of the houses as we see them now today. There would have been just little roadside cottages and things like that, you know. And it must have been a marvellous occasion, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Tell me, Liam, finally, your own work, what are you doing at the moment, and what are you involved in?
Well, I still am finding turning stones around the village is still revealing information, and is still revealing new little bits of history of the village, and sort of going on different tracks and trying to research different periods and so on. At the moment, I'm very interested in two things, really. The old Slade Road, which is an old coach route which went through the village before the main Blessington Road was built, and it took people to the sort of southeast of the country, down around, say, Carlow, Wexford, without going down the coast. It was the route, and that went through Saggart. It was the Bee and Coneys that were used at that time, not only for mail carriage but also for to take people. And there's a wonderful old bridge called the Slade Bridge, a four arch bridge which was built to take the coaches across a relatively small river in the Slade. And it should be, really, in my opinion, it should be restored, and that route, which is now only used as a walk route, should be, you know, should be sort of helped and maybe improved for walkers, because it could eventually lead up to the Wicklow Dublin Mountains. It would be a wonderful tourist and local asset to have, you know.
Yeah. Well, Liam Roach, I wish you the best of luck in that adventure, and thank you very much indeed for talking to me.
Thank you. Pleasure.